The Millennial Express, plowing ever onward through a northern winter. From station to station, bringing the dissident right to you.
Hello, and welcome back to Millennial 2023. I am now with one of the most hotly anticipated guests each year. And I should also say, he's one of only two guests who have appeared on every single Millennial, the other being Greg Johnson. This is the inimitable Jared Taylor. Welcome back to Millennial.
Well, thank you so much. I saw an introduction. This is Millennial number 9, is it?
Yes.
Congratulations to you. You're almost into double digits, and I salute you, as always, for doing this marathon session. Certainly, I could not do anything similar, but it's a pleasure and an honor to be with you. Thank you very much for inviting me.
Well, thank you very much. I would have to say, I think that putting on any sort of event in real life must be very stressful, and I can't imagine myself being able to do something like that. I think the stress of so many possible things going wrong, having to defend against that, and that would really do me in. Something like Millennial is more feasible for me. Well, I don't think I need to introduce you. I think everyone who's watching will already know who you are.
Don't count on that.
Okay, then. Well, why don't you introduce yourself, just in case anyone doesn't know who you are?
Well, my name is Jared Taylor, and I'm the editor of the website American Renaissance, amren.com. And I have been an out-of-the-closet advocate for our people for more than 30 years now. And I consider the site to be one devoted to race realism and also to advocacy for white people. So that, in a nutshell, is who I am.
And obviously the name would imply a focus on America, but your concern is international. And you have spent a lot of time in Europe, not so much recently because of political machinations to prevent you from doing so. But
yes,
your concern is for all of us, isn't it?
In a way, I now regret having chosen that name, because we Americans, we really are Europeans. And what I am hoping for is very much a European Renaissance. I think of Americans and Canadians, South Africans, Australians, New Zealanders, all of us. We are Europeans. We are part of the European diaspora, and we may be far away, but we are sons and daughters of the old continent. When I think about I myself and my colleagues, our language, our outlook, everything about us, the religion of our ancestors, it's European through and through and through and through and through. So at the tips of my toes, I consider myself a European, but a Southern American variant of European. So yes, in a way, American is limiting, and I regret having chosen that name, but I think it's too late to change it now.
Yes, yes. But you don't consider yourself a Japanese variant of a European?
No. That's just not possible. That's not possible. But for those who don't know, someone might hint at such a thing, because I was born in Japan and lived there for 16 years. And as an accident of birth, I speak fluent Japanese. But no, much as I like Japanese, I'm really a great lover of Japan and its culture, I feel very comfortable there. I never would have thought that I was a Japanese person, and Japanese people don't think so either. And long may these distinctions remain.
Yes, indeed. And you're also fluent in French as well, it's worth saying. I've seen you speaking French.
That, in fact, is something of which I am more proud than the fact that I speak Japanese, because Japanese I acquired the same way I acquired English, simply by being alive in this environment from a young age. but I had to study French as an adult, and so I worked hard at that. And perhaps I might even say that this is, I suppose, as good an opportunity as any to mention that one of the pleasantest things that happened to me this year was the opportunity to meet Renaud Camus. He is, of course, the great Frenchman who, among other things, coined the expression the great replacement. And we had a video chat together. It was in French, and I was a little worried about meeting him in this manner, because he is such a distinguished person, a very highly cultivated person. I thought that he might be a little stuffy, a little full of himself, but he is just the most charming, delightful man. And it really rekindled my desire to meet him. He really is one of the great figures of our movement. And it's a terrible pity that his work has only recently been translated into English. But there is a new volume out of his work. It's called Enemy of the Disaster. I believe that's the name of it. But Renaud Camus, again, the person who came up with the phrase, the great replacement, and who has described it and analyzed it really with, I think, brilliant insight after brilliant insight. It was really one of the great joys of this fall, or even this whole year, to have had that opportunity to speak with him. Really a wonderful, wonderful man.
Right. The great replacement is obviously a phrase that has become central to what we do and to many people's understanding of the situation. And it's interesting that it does seem to be becoming a mainstream phrase now. Yeah. I mean, there was the famous thing with the Vivek, I can't remember his surname, sorry.
Ramaswamy. You are forgiven for not remembering that surname.
Okay, Ramaswamy. Yes. Okay. Well, yeah, and he said it in a presidential, I can't remember the term, the candidacy.
The presidential debate, yes.
Yeah. So this is, do you see this as a step forward? Surely it is.
Yes. It's wonderful that anyone in a high-profile position, it's a pity that it takes an Indian-American to do this kind of breakthrough. But Tucker Carlson, of course, the television host, has been talking about the great replacement for some time. To me, it's quite hilarious the way the other side tries to dismiss it. When we talk about it, it's a conspiracy theory. It's unfounded. But they, in their own way, they talk about it. They look forward to the day when whites become a minority, because they know perfectly well that many of their policies will come to fruition if that were to happen. So the great replacement is a wonderful thing, so long as you don't use that term, and so long as you are a progressive or an American Democrat, and you're looking forward to the day when the Democrat Party is the party that is perpetually in power with no visible opposition on the horizon. When we point out that the population is changing, no, first of all, it's not happening. And even if it were happening, it's a wonderful thing. So you shut up. So it's great when people talk about it and take for granted what is happening. And just to put it in the most obvious terms, in 1960, the population of the United States was almost 90% white. Now it's barely 60% white, and probably by 2040 or so, whites will become a minority. And I'm absolutely convinced that in 1965, when you had told the Congress that got rid of our immigration policy designed to keep the country European, if you told them, well, you know, you realize 70, 80 years, white people are going to be a minority on account of this, they would have said, what? No way on earth we're going to vote for this. But it was slipped into legislation with the promise that there would be no important changes in the racial mix of the population. In any case, we are certainly being replaced. And I think that white people, we Europeans, have absolutely every right, even a duty, to resist this until our dying breaths.
Oh, absolutely. I think it was actually said to the American people when the Hart-Celler Act was passed that it wouldn't alter the demographics of the country.
That's right.
And it's amazing that they would say that, something so obviously untrue. It's amazing that the American public fell for it. And it's amazing that as the reality has unfolded, nobody has ever acknowledged this and apologized. But of course, it's to do with the entire culture at the top of American society.
Expecting Americans, prominent Americans of any stripe, to apologize is just an utterly fond and futile hope. On the subject of apologies, I think the people who engineered the American war in Iraq, those people, by the standards of the Nuremberg trials, were war criminals. The Nazis were hanged at Nuremberg for waging aggressive war. Well, if the war against Iraq was not an aggressive war, I sure don't know what is. The pretext was weapons of mass destruction. I thought they'd be so embarrassed they would at least plant a bucket of anthrax virus or something, but they didn't even do that. Well, I guess we were wrong. Yeah, no weapons of mass destruction. Well, what's next? And the people who got us into that war, have they ever apologized? No. But as I say, the Germans, the Nazis in Nuremberg, they swung from the end of a short rope on account of that. But asking them to apologize, no. No chance of that. But the people who passed the Hartzeller Act in 1965, I suspect some of them really did expect that there would be an eventual wholesale replacement of European Americans. But I suspect most of the people who voted for it did not think so. They believed that this is kind of a cosmetic thing. And you have to recall that this was during the Cold War, and the United States was competing with the Soviet Union for the attentions and the affections of third world countries, and it made it a little more difficult to do so if we were trying to be very friendly with, the Congolese or people from Malaysia, but we wouldn't let any of them into the country. And so the idea was, okay, we'll just let a handful of them in. We changed our policy, and they will love us. They will clutch us to their bosoms all around the world. Well, it didn't work either way. It was far more than a handful, and they still don't love us.
Yeah, indeed. And this is a situation that we've talked about an awful lot over the years, especially yes. You, going back much further than me. But you said to me when we were off air that you have a renewed optimism. And in fact, you said you were brimming with optimism. I wrote it down.
Uh-oh. Throwing my words back into my face.
No, not at all, because I too am... I feel good. You know, I think 2015, 16, people are comparing it with that. I think in a way it's better because we're more informed now than we were then. Yes. And it's a bit less chaotic on our side than it was then. So take it away.
Well, yes, we are older and wiser, I'd like to think, than we were in 2016. I'm certainly older. And I detect a certain increased wisdom around me. In a way, well, it's just the number of people who, despite this hammer and tongs, tooth and nail censorship against which we are constantly fighting, despite all of these attempts to muzzle us, it's clear that more and more and more and more people are coming our way, despite the fact that American Renaissance can't have a Twitter account. Our YouTube channel has been blasted ever since, I guess it was 2018. We are reaching so many more people. And it's also the fact that there are so many more Twitter accounts, if you will, or video channels that are bringing this message to people. The censors are simply failing. And I get a sense that more and more Americans certainly are realizing just what is at stake, just how awful our rulers are behaving. And so I get a sense, as I had in 2016, that there is a kind of awakening. We are reaching a kind of, I don't know, the tectonic plate is on the verge of shifting in some sort of earthquake. And so long as the earthquake just doesn't destroy the country, and I don't think it will be a good thing. It will be a good thing. And of course, there are all the developments in Europe that are encouraging the number of so-called far-right parties that are increasing in attracting voters. And it does seem that Eastern Europe is certainly holding the line against mass immigration, no matter how much the European Union pounds on them and expects those countries to just follow them into degeneracy. So perhaps I'm just a natural optimist. Perhaps that accounts for the fact that I'm still in this business after 30 years. But no, I think that there probably are real reasons. It's not just my foolish view of things improving. I believe there really are signs of something important that's happening. One thing in the United States that I believe is really waking up a lot of people is the consequences of this Hamas-Israel war. Now, you've probably had many guests who have talked about this at length. I don't wish to spend too much time at it, but this has shown, first of all, how dangerous and divisive diversity is. Here we have these utterly warring factions on American campuses, in American society, and anyone who says that this is a strength is obviously wrong. And second, it has become clear that American Jews and Israelis are now lumped in with white oppressors. And if someone is completely swallowed up, as so many young Americans are, by this idea that the only cleavages in society that really matter are those between oppressor and oppressed. And if, as they've been taught that this is the only thing that matters, and men are oppressors, and heterosexuals are oppressors, but the uber oppressors are whites. And to the extent that they can see Israelis as settler colonialists or architects of an apartheid oppressive regime, Jews become uber oppressors. And so Jews can no longer escape being identified as whites. And I suspect that for at least some of them, it will push them into the camp of the West. And this has at any rate opened a lot of people's eyes to just what this whole concept of DEI, diversity,
equity and inclusion.
Equity. Yeah, how could I forget equity? Yes, this DEI business. Just what a racket, and just how much harm it does. And I guess I should have added also, there are state legislatures in the United States that, having tumbled to this, are passing laws saying that, well, they're state universities, they're not going to fund this stuff anymore. And I believe it was in the state of Ohio. It got to the point where the state legislature said, okay, you're expecting this $800 million installment to run the universities, pay your salaries, keep the buildings going. But in exchange, you're going to have to really cut back on this DEI nonsense. Well, quite interestingly enough, the university system said, nope, keep your $800 million. We are going to continue in our anti-white ways. But the mere fact that we got to this Mexican standoff, if I can use this expression without insulting our southern neighbors, this is, I think, a very important sign of the battle lines becoming clearer and clearer and clearer. And as you probably know, in Florida, our governor has been very good about trying to carve away all of this DEI nonsense in universities and in the various bureaucracies, teaching sexual confusion in the schools. So I see a resistance not only at the level of we dissidents who live in this sort of semi-underground twilight, but also in the people who are above ground, attacking some of the most obvious targets and some of the most obvious engineers of our dispossession.
Yeah, I mean, my concern would be that what will happen is wokery, as in this very out in the open, very extreme, very proud dispossession of discrediting of white people, dispossession of them in society. My concern would be that that would be done away with, but. And we would return to the 90s, early 2000s situation where everyone's equal while we slowly get replaced. That would be my concern here. So they'll stop being so open about it, but it will continue anyway under the radar. However, I don't think that's actually, and I think that's what a lot of people would want to happen here. A lot of our opponents would, and the center-right, the conservatives, they would like that to happen. But I don't think that can happen anymore because the non-whites are just too powerful in our society now. And what we've seen with American universities, Harvard and Yale and others, I think MIT perhaps, I can't remember. No, probably not MIT.
Well, MIT was on the hot seat recently.
Well, was it as well? Right. There are loads of non-white professors who have been installed in these universities over the last 20, 30 years, and they won't put the woke away. And why should they? Why it's not in their interest, and they've got the power. They own these castles from which they can operate. So there's no reason for them to go along with that. They can continue advocating against white interests and for their own interests. And so that's actually good for us because it means that this battle is not going to go back to the more muted and insidious mode of the early 2000s. It's going to remain out in the open, and white people are going to remain fully aware, ever more aware, of the danger that they're in.
I think there's no question about that. And that is why so many people are waking up now. Whether or not whites, we will be numerous enough and powerful enough and brave enough, because it takes a certain amount of bravery to go against all of the orthodoxies, to really salvage any portion of the United States in any meaningful way for European man and European civilization. That's an open question. I'm not sure it can be done, but more and more people are certainly thinking in those terms. It's true also that we had this Supreme Court ruling on affirmative action. And so some of the more glaring and brazen forms of anti-white discrimination, it'll be a little harder to do those things. It'll be much easier to sue these universities for what they're doing. And there are a number of public interest law firms that are doing so. America First Legal, which is run by Stephen Miller, who was in the White House under Donald Trump. And also there is FIRE. I forget now what that stands for. Something like the foundation. I'm going to embarrass myself by not remembering, but it's a very much of a free speech organization. It's busy suing people as well. All of these things are combating this nonsense out in the open. Now, one of the real problems is the number of so-called conservatives who persist in thinking, well, the only problem is all of this racial politicking, identity politics that all of these non-white groups are pushing. And white people don't dare do that because that might tear the country apart. Well, do they really think that these non-whites who have profited so handsomely from pushing their interests at the expense of whites are suddenly going to be talked into thinking that, oh, no, we're not blacks, we're not Hispanics, we're all Americans. What an idea. Well, that was the whole theory of the so-called civil rights movement back in the 1950s, 1960s.
Hispanics are natural Americans kind of thing.
Yes, they're natural conservatives. That was the whole idea, natural conservatives. And blacks, you know, once we stopped mistreating them, it was going to become clear that they are just like us. They are like whites and blacks are collectively identical twins who are reared apart, and get them out of the horrible environmental morass that vicious white people have shoved them into for hundreds of years, and they'll just behave just like us. And of course, that hasn't happened. Even despite decades of favoritism and preferences for blacks. And I'm concentrating on blacks now because they are the age-old racial fault line in the United States. And as if we didn't have enough racial fault lines, of course, we started importing all of these other people. So we have all of this wonderful diversity. But as it turned out, no matter how hard we tried, blacks did not end up being just like white people. And of course, it's because the real explanation for this, racial differences in average IQ and temperament, are absolutely taboo. That's why inevitably, we ended up with all of these voodoo explanations as to why blacks, especially and secondarily Hispanics, don't do as well as whites. This systemic racism.
Just on that matter, yesterday or the day before on Twitter, I saw one of those awful Krasenstein brothers saying this very point. I think he put up some educational attainment scores and said, how do you explain this? If there isn't racism, how can this be going on?
Exactly. Well,
and of course, people were saying, like, you're not open to the real explanations. So, you know, sorry to interrupt.
No, that's precisely the point. If I were one of these non-white activists, I would put it as bluntly as possible. I would say, well, of course, we agree that the human races are, on average, equal, right down to the 10th decimal point. And so if blacks aren't doing as well as whites, given that they're just as smart and hardworking, determined and talented as white people, there can be only one exception, or only one explanation. It's because you wicked white people, past and present, and probably future and unborn, are poisoning our lives. And your standard conservative is left mumbling nonsense about fatherlessness and a dysfunctional culture. I really blame the conservatives for this. They would slit their wrists rather than pronounce two letters of the alphabet, IQ. And I think many of them are absolutely bound to know better, but they are terrified of actually explaining what the cause of these disparate achievement levels is. And so long as they remain paralyzed and cowardly and utterly spineless, there is no way that they can defend themselves.
That's the thing. They're castrating themselves.
Yes.
It makes you unable to participate truthfully or effectively in the debate. Yes. All you can actually do is acquiesce to your opponent's position that, it must be that our society is deeply racist.
Yes.
In time, you're going to have to acquiesce to that, even though it's untrue and you don't believe it.
That's something just
And,
you know, another aspect of this is I think society exerts a tremendous power over these so-called conservatives by forcing them to pay lip service to something that they probably do not believe. If they've read Charles Murray and the Bell Curve, and if they've read Michael Levin and Linda Gottfredson, or all these people have laid out the reality of the situation extremely carefully and persuasively, and I'm sure many of them have. So they know what the truth is. But they are gritting their teeth and pretending to believe otherwise. This is, as you say, it's psychological self-castration. And how can that not but affect them in deep, almost spiritual ways? So to me, there are many, many aspects of American society that one simply cannot understand if one refuses to accept this fundamental fact of racial differences in temperament and average ability. Nothing makes sense in America. And until we're prepared to say, look, here's the explanation. As I put it, we will have won the day when in some PTA meeting, some parent teacher association meeting, in Massachusetts someplace, a PTA mother gets them and says, well, yeah, it's too bad that there are no blacks in the AP physics class. But, you know, that 15-point IQ difference on the average really makes a difference. And that's the end of the discussion. And then we go on to discuss the school Christmas party. That's when we will have won. And I don't see that happening next year. But I think we are slowly, painfully moving in that direction.
Yeah. Because the other thing, and I started saying this a few years ago, is when someone says, you know, prove that the races are different or something, I think you can reply to them by saying, well, prove to them, prove that they're the same.
Yes.
But why do you believe in equality? Why?
Exactly.
It's not borne out by everyday experience. It's not borne out by scientific inquiry. It's not borne out by history.
Yes.
And it's not borne out by common sense. It doesn't make, why would the races be the same?
Yes.
There's no reason for that.
Exactly.
You either believe that evolution, I mean, this is the whole thing about evolution stopping at the neck. Yeah. You either believe that that evolution matters and environment affects how a species evolves, or you don't. It's really one or the other. And we did. We were separate for long enough for real differences to emerge between us.
There's a marvelous book by Gregory Cochran and Henry Harpending called The 10,000-Year Explosion. And it points out that contra the views of the anti-racists, that there's really been no meaningful evolution, certainly not of the brain, for the last 50,000, maybe 100,000 years. That the last 10,000 years has seen just a swooping increase in speed of evolution, partly because of the environments that human beings have created. If you have an environment where there's literacy, where there's trade, where people lend money or beginning to lend money, and you can accumulate, gosh, that puts all sorts of different environmental pressures on the humans who are living in that environment compared to those who are still in the hunter-gatherer stage or really haven't lived in cities or haven't got written alphabet and that kind of thing. So evolution has really been speeding up. It's not as though it stopped 50,000 years ago. And as these two authors put it, the idea that the races could be evolving to the point that they are physically as different as they are, and then to conclude that somehow the brains are identical or unchanged from the common ancestor of as much as 200,000 years ago, that's as likely as taking a handful of silver dollars and tossing them out and having them all land on edge. In other words, the possibility of that is zero. And yet, as you say, it should be incumbent upon those who say that we are equal to explain their totally implausible position. And yet it's incumbent on us to explain the obvious.
Yes. And also the thing is that we shouldn't even need to explain it, because yes, a two-year-old would understand this.
Right.
That
right.
Things that look different often are different.
Yes. That's right. That's right.
It really is that simple. I think that liberals and progressives and so on tend to think, well, that's so simple, you're embarrassing yourself by saying it. Wow. If you believe something so simple, you must be a moron.
Well, you know, I have had some insight into this little problem on two occasions. Once was, it must have been 20 years ago. In California, I met a woman at a party, and I don't know why exactly. I guess it had to do with her asking me what I did for a living, and then we started talking about race and race differences. And she was very much a liberal, and the idea that races could be different in any substantial way, how preposterous. And I started explaining to her one of the reasons. There's so many obvious reasons to think that they are different in some fundamental way. And she said, well, that can't be true, because if it's true, we'll just have to exterminate them all. And I said, wait a minute. No. That's really not a logical conclusion to draw. For generations, Americans assumed and understood that there were important differences between blacks and whites. And nobody talked in terms of exterminating them, for heaven's sake. And then another conversation I had some years after that, there was a similar reaction that this, because if this is true, then we have to oppress them. That to me is a kind of window on maybe something that's going on in the brains of liberals, that there's something vindictive, something mean-spirited about their own view that would lead them to assume that this is the necessary conclusion. But still, at the same time, most of the time, people will grasp at even the flimsiest reasons to think that they or their group is superior in some way to other individuals or to other groups. And yet, in this respect, so many whites are just clutching for any possible reason to not admit that they are smarter on average than blacks, but that that just can't be. I find that many whites are much more willing to entertain the possibility that East Asians are on average smarter than whites than that whites are smarter than blacks. There's this kind of inverted anti-whiteness that just seems to have paralyzed the thinking of so many people. But again, I think that reality is slowly chipping away at this self-delusion.
Yeah, I really wonder about this. It's something that I've encountered myself, and it's possible that you and I have talked about this previously, but I don't think so. But this idea among liberals that, well, if there are racial differences, if some people are just organic, genetically bound to be less intelligent, then then the only thing to do is to eliminate them from the species.
Right.
I don't see that at all, but I do think that there is a strain in the left who think in these very eugenic terms. Like they, so therefore, they have to block off the possibility of difference, because their only way of dealing with difference is to eliminate it. It's a strange thing, especially when they're the ones who go on about how wonderful difference is.
That's right.
Let's leave that aside. That's obviously something they tell themselves. So it's a strange thing. We're the ones who acknowledge real difference and actually accept it.
Well, you know, this is a point that your other regular year-in, year-out guest, Greg Johnson, has said, that it's almost a kind of inverted white supremacy when white progressives, so to speak, assume that they have the power, almost unconsciously, that whites have this incredible power to psychologically enslave and force blacks, almost without wanting to, the power of their minds through systemic or even colorblind racism, not even wanting to, we force them to have these high murder rates and illegitimacy rates and stay poor and all of this. The whole idea that, the slogan that particularly amuses and by turns amuses and by turns incenses me is, white silence is violence. But good grief. A white person can't sit quietly, have a cup of coffee without, in effect, kicking some black man in the shins. In other words, the idea is that white people have to consciously be thinking and saying wonderful things about blacks. And if they're not, they're committing such violence to them that they are ruining their lives. I mean, you'd have to have superpowers, absolute untold superpowers to accomplish this kind of evil. And as I say, Greg Johnson makes the point that this ascribes to whites just unusual powers, psychological powers, almost magical levels of power. So maybe that's part of it too. I don't know. The trouble is, in my experience, I have on several occasions tried to get to the bottom of what real progressives think about what genuinely accounts for racial differences in achievement. And they won't really talk to you seriously. Or if they do, then they react in this utterly surprising way. But, well, we're just going to have to exterminate. Well, gosh, you can't get them into a reasonable discussion. And perhaps it's, as you say, they are just psychologically paralyzed by what they think, obviously mistakenly, would be the inevitable consequence of arriving at this, what is to them, horrible, unpleasant conclusion.
It's a very strange thing.
They're very strange.
It's not what you would expect, because again, they also claim to be up for helping people and the disadvantaged. Right. But then, if they learn that the people are genetically disadvantaged, then their charity goes away, and their only option is to eliminate it. Because I think that would be their way of achieving. Well, then there would be equality.
Well, but you know, there is. I mean, this is something I've imagined also. Let us imagine a world in which these genome-wide association studies have proven that the distribution of high IQ associated genes is different from race to race. And so, no, we can't claim that it's a dysfunctional culture, and we can't claim that it's the wickedness of whites in the past that is causing these differences in results. It's really a genetic difference. Well, then, the next step could be, well, that's not their fault. That is no more their fault than the fact that we enslaved them, or we mistreated them, or we lynched them. And so, okay, then justice requires that the dice be loaded and the whole system be rigged so as to give them benefits to make up for this bad luck, this bad genetic hand they've been dealt. I don't think that's entirely out of the question, although I think for most people, the people who would be suffering on account of this and who would be playing with the dice loaded against them, we would have a much harder time accepting that if that were the argument.
Sorry, I was just dealing with a technical thing there. Okay, there have been several super chats posted already, expecting. So I will open those now, because otherwise they do tend to pile up.
Oh, by all means. And I tend to jabber on and on. So,
people love hearing you jabber on and on. That's what they look forward to each year. Mm. You have a very, very articulate way of jabbering.
If one must jabber. But yes, let's hear the super chats.
Okay. Okay, hold on a second. Rick says, Rick's asking about the involvement of a certain tribe in what's going on, the great replacement, and that whites are the great oppressors. He's asking if there's any particular group responsible for that.
Well, of course, I mean, there's no question. Of course, he's trying to get me, as so many people often try to do, get me to name the Jew. Well, I think there's no question that Jews have been extremely active in all of these movements that have the effect of undermining any kind of legitimate white racial consciousness. But I am not among those who say that, therefore, all Jews are enemies. I think there are Jews who are true men of the West. And I think that many of them will come around. But this is a very important question. It's not the one that I've made central to my life's work, but it is an entirely legitimate question. And I'm sure others of your guests will be dealing with this as a more central question than I have.
Yes, indeed. Okay, end of the line, Joel. Joel, I'm not sure. Thanks, Woz and Jared. Despite Jared's well-founded misgivings about free speech in America, the situation in Ireland is arguably worse.
Oh, yes.
The concept of hate speech is well embedded, both culturally and legislatively.
Yes.
Increasingly, we rely on dissident allies in other countries to echo our voice or to speak for us. This is an embarrassing reality, and it's also true of Britain. As has been well rehearsed, that with some issues we need to rely on Americans to say it for us, because we would just be in prison, or our lives would be turned upside down with court cases if we were to say things. It's embarrassing and humiliating, but it's just a reality. Ireland.
To me, Ireland is one of the most grievous cases of a small country that fought for generations, centuries even, for autonomy and independence, and then now practically without pausing to take a breath, has decided that it's somehow its duty to open itself up to the rest of the world. It's just a tragic, tragic betrayal. And I don't have many Irish ancestors. If I look hard in my ancestral tree, there are people of Irish origin, not many, but I feel such a deep, deep kinship to people for whom that is their native ancestral land. They never had an empire. They never enslaved non-whites. They were never imperialists. And what on earth is behind the idea that Ireland should be for everyone? This quite small country with a population of autochthonous white people who have roots that go back millennia, who love their land, they're supposed to give it up? And it seems that despite even some of the parties, Sinn Féin, for example, back when the enemy was Britain, doesn't Sinn Féin mean ourselves alone? Isn't that what it means? Well, for heaven's sake, whatever happened even to the name of the party? And these people are all open to this idea that no, wherever you are, Somalis or Middle Easterners or Muslims, whoever you are, you'll all become a good Irishman. This is outrageous, outrageous. And although I can never recommend any kind of illegality, I certainly understand why people are burning down some of these hotels or these buildings that have been designated for the people that Irishmen and Irish women have never invited in. Ireland has a terrible housing shortage as it is. And we're setting aside these buildings for people who have absolutely no right to Ireland. I tell you, this infuriates me as much as anything that's going on in the world today.
Absolutely. And we should say that we're not advocating anything like that. It's just, it's understandable. I mean, yes. I don't know what the establishment were expecting, but for Irish people, at yes. least some of them, to do things like this.
That's right.
You cannot, dispossess a population in the way that's being done without there being a backlash. It's just inevitable. Actually, regardless of what you and I say, you and I could sit here like a pair of hippies and beg Irish dissidents not to do this, and it would have no effect whatsoever. I mean, it's going to happen.
Yes, it's their land. It belongs to them. That is, and survival is the first law. And they are doing what they see is necessary to survive. And it is the people who are forcing this kind of action upon them who are the true criminals.
Absolutely. I think it's also worth saying that it is they who are doing something extreme. Yes. They are what they are doing to Ireland and all of our countries is unutterably extreme. It would have been inconceivable to our ancestors that something this extreme could happen and could be done or would ever be done. So when they call us extremists, I just,
Yes. Well, it just goes to show you how deep the rot goes. In a place like France, for example, France did have an overseas empire. And you can make some kind of absurd, stilted argument about how the colonies were exploited. I think the colonies were in large part hugely benefited by colonization. But the French were there uninvited, and the French did things uninvited. I think the effect, by and large, was enormous benefit of the colonized. You can make some sort of argument about that. And in the case of the United States, you could say, well, yes, these black people were brought over here against their will, and they were slaves, and then they were objects of segregation. And the American Indians, you know, look what happened to them. You can make arguments of that kind about certain European countries, but not about Ireland. Not about Switzerland, not about Sweden. Some of these countries are utterly and entirely innocent. And yet this self-loathing of which whites seem to be uniquely capable has transferred itself to just about every country on this side of what we used to call the Iron Curtain. And we used to look across that Iron Curtain and feel sorry for these Bulgarians and Czechs and Slovaks and all the rest of them suffering under the heavy heel of Soviet domination, and that sentiment was not misplaced, but at least they have preserved some sort of healthy notion of nation, of heritage, of destiny that they're determined to preserve. It's a very odd consequence of the Cold War that the people who lost the Cold War at least won, at least for now, the psychological war of wanting, having a genuine sense of patriotism about their own countries.
Of course, you're right. You're absolutely right about the guilt tripping. With each country, there's something in the history that enables them to be bent over a barrel, and it's used against them.
But wait, what in the history of Ireland would that be?
Well, it's interesting. Do you know what it is? It's the fact that many Irish people emigrated. So that means that well, Irish were migrants. So therefore, we should be nice to these migrants.
Oh, boy. And I suppose there were a number of Irishmen in the India service. There were Irishmen who were active in maintaining the empire. But good grief, just because, I mean, the Irish were driven out of their country because of all of these horrible depredations. And then that means they need to turn around and open up their, all right. It means they're just grasping at any kind of straw to explain their own suicidal.
Of course, but the more it's repeated, the more people will buy it. And it's stupid for two reasons. The first is that the Irish who left are not the Irish who still remain there now, and therefore that shouldn't be used against them. Yeah. And second, it actually utilizes a concept of race, which at the same, the Irish people emigrated. Well, then there is a thing called the Irish people. These contradictions, of course, are of no interest to the people who are using this argument.
Yes, presumably the ones who stayed liked it there. They liked it the way it was. And somehow,
they're specifically the ones who didn't emigrate. So why?
Yes. No, and they're to be punished for the behavior of those who left the country, who turned their back on it in certain respect. No, none of this makes sense. There's something about white people. I mean, we've had this conversation before previously. I've got this whole elaborate theory of what might tend to make white people so susceptible to these kind of manipulative arguments. But even all the arguments that I've tried to muster of cudgeling my brains on this question for decades now, I don't have a satisfactory answer. There's something about white people that just makes us susceptible to this kind of horrible, a kind of twisted generosity in a way that no other race, no other group of people could possibly be manipulated into falling for.
I think that we're just obsessed with morality and being moral, being good people, so that can be used against us.
Someone
pointed out another reason it's ridiculous is that the Irish who emigrated went and worked hard and built the countries, actually did improve those countries. The migrants who are arriving in Ireland are not behaving like that.
No.
Very much not like that. So it's a completely... false equivalency that's being drawn there. Insincere, so dishonest.
A couple of months ago, there was just yet another round of riots when some young French, well, they call him French, North African thug on a motorcycle gets stopped by police, petty criminal. And then France just erupts in violence and car burnings and burning down libraries and the rest of it. And I looked back to find out when was the first Arab riot in France. It was in 1997, for heaven's sake. And how many riots, how many burnt cars, how many burnt government centers, how many dead Frenchmen does it take for white people to figure out that this is no good? That Islam, North Africans, these people are incompatible with French civility. What does it take? Now, at least the French had the benefit of this Algerian, or I guess you shouldn't call him an Algerian because he's of Jewish heritage, but Eric Zemmour at least was a presidential candidate who was prepared to say, these people are incompatible with our civilization. Why are white people so unable to state the obvious? This is just such a mystery to me. But it's, again, we must be grateful for the Eastern Europeans who, they don't necessarily express themselves quite as forcefully and quite as explicitly as we might like, but they sometimes come pretty close to it.
Yes, indeed. All right. Okay, here's a question from Baxter. Does Jared think Gavin Newsom will be the last ever white nominee for the Democrat Party in 2028?
Possibly. It's entirely possible. The Democrat Party, of course, it is composed of so many factions that under ordinary circumstances should be at war against each other. Blacks and Hispanics really do not get along. And blacks and the sexually confused people who are the pets of the Democratic Party, they don't get along. All of these groups are held together by a kind of politics of resentment. And the object of their resentment is people like you and me, white men. Now, if it gets to the point where there are so few white people left in the country that the Democrats become the perpetual power, it might be the case that all of these warring factions among the Democratic Party can only establish some sort of compromise among themselves by nominating a white person. I don't know. But it is entirely possible that, yes, Gavin Newsom, although, you know, even Democrats, some of them say, well, you know, he hasn't really done much for California. Are we really going to put him in charge of the entire United States? So who knows? I mean, Gavin Newsom, of course, is licking his chops at the prospect of becoming the nominee, and who knows what will happen. But, yes, it's entirely possible. At the same time, who knows? The Republicans, I suppose, as you probably realize, Kevin McCarthy, the former Speaker of the House, bigwig Republican, just I think a week or two ago, he was complaining about how the Democrat Party looks like America. Our party looks like the most exclusive country club. In other words, full of white people. What the heck? These are white people, are the people who support your party. Good grief. And this guy is complaining? So it's entirely possible that if Donald Trump is a nominee, he could be the last nominee of the Republican Party. White people are just so prepared to just make life miserable for their own people, apologize for even existing. You never can tell whether it's Republicans or Democrats.
All right. And another question. This one is from Potato Mutt. Hmm. Uncle Jared.
Yes.
Do you know that you're called Uncle Jared by a lot of people?
I know that, and yeah. I don't mind at all.
No, it's a term of endearment.
Just so long it doesn't become Grandpa Jared anytime soon.
Okay. So, Potato Mutt. I think that might be an Irish-American. I'm not sure.
Oh, yes.
Towards the end of your debate with E. Michael Jones 2 years ago, he said he would send you a copy of a certain book, his book, The Jewish Revolutionary Spirit. Mm-hmm. He would send it to you pro bono, and it would change your life. Mm-hmm. Did you receive it? Did you read it? And did it change your life? The people need a follow-up.
The answer to all three questions is no, no, and no. I did not receive the book. So the onus is upon him to change my life.
Okay. All right. Total Kermit Domination said, "Your jabbering is gold to us, Mr. Taylor, and has been for decades. Merry Christmas, you both of you, and all."
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much. And I appreciate being wished a Merry Christmas. And in that light, I will tell you a gruesome story of my own from 2 years ago. I bought a Christmas tree at a church. Sometimes churches have Christmas tree lots, sort of a fundraising thing. And you pay a little bit more if you buy a Christmas tree at a church than if you buy it at one of these Christmas tree farms. But it was nearby and it was a pretty tree. And when I paid for the tree, the fellow who sold it to me wished me happy holidays. And I said, for heaven's sake, you just sold me a Christmas tree. Can't you wish me a Merry Christmas? Gosh, this is another aspect of this pathetic self-effacing that our people seem to specialize in. So thank you very much for those Christmas wishes. And I guess while I'm at it, I should wish all of your viewers Merry Christmas.
Thank you very much. Yeah, I just went to Google to see what their Google Doodle thing is. And it says Festive Holidays 2023.
Yes, well, you know, we're celebrating, what is it?
Kwanzaa and Diwali, yeah. I guess. And
yes, maybe Kwanzaa, Hanukkah, who knows? Probably, is there some Indian Hindu feast day?
Diwali. Yeah.
Diwali, yes. Diwali. What is it? Yes, they've got something going. Probably the Muslims have got something going, too. So, yes, we're all going to hold hands and sing Havana Gila. And, and that's how we'll celebrate Christmas.
Yeah, I can just imagine you and me doing that, Jared. It seems very plausible indeed.
Yes.
and then B. Dawson says, "Merry Christmas, Uncle Jared. I myself am also brimming with optimism. This year definitely feels different, similar to 2016. Definitely feels a lot better than last year.
Yes.
I almost felt guilty last year for depressing everyone with millennial because it was quite a... quite a negative, and I certainly that's the opposite of what I wanted, but it just happened because of the news cycle. I'm afraid the last year was a bloody depressing year.
Well, to me, 2020 was a particularly depressing year, and maybe
that was the worst.
Yes. May 25th, 2020, when George Floyd ascended into heaven, that set off something I would just never have expected. We spoke about that on that occasion. But we've certainly looked things are looking up compared to that. Just the headlong way in which white people just decided that they were absolutely no good. They're going to pour billions of dollars into making life better and more equitable for these wonderful black rioters. Anyway, yes, it's a much better year. And I'm glad to hear that your viewers and listeners agree.
Yes, yes, definitely. Okay, Sore Arm says, Merry Christmas, Uncle Jared, Woz, and everyone else on the stream. That's very nice. Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
Open Borders says, here in Australia, the main centre-left newspaper is going into hysterics about Donald Trump's recent anti-immigration speech. They quoted Jonathan Greenblatt from the ADL, calling it xenophobic and racist. Yet the same newspapers never look at Israel's immigration policies or anti-immigration with the same attitude. Well, of course, and that's cliched behavior. It's to be expected.
Yes.
But Donald Trump is rising again in the as a public profile in the news. That's a whole thing because, as I keep saying, next year the election will have happened by the time.
Yes. If I may say something about that. The fact that a man with, I mean, somebody's counted up all the felony counts he's facing, I think it's 89, that a man facing 89 felony counts and being besieged by one lawsuit after another, both civil and criminal, for a person in his predicament to be leading the pack for the Republican nomination, and in the polls now, he's as much as 5 or 10 points ahead of his most likely Democrat candidate, Joe Biden. This is an extraordinary thing. And it goes to show you the profound disaffection of tens of millions of Americans. It's impossible to imagine, even, I believe, as late as the 1970s, 80s, maybe even 90s, certainly never in the 20th century, could a man who faced this kind of legal formidable problems, it would have been assumed that where there is smoke, there is fire, that this man was utterly disqualified from the presidency. The fact that so many Republicans continue to support Donald Trump is proof of how little faith, how much utter contempt they have for their own government, their own justice system, their own elected or appointed prosecutors. This is an extraordinary testament to the incredible division that the United States now suffers from. And this, too, is for me a reason for optimism. The extent to which ordinary Americans distrust their government, distrust the media, refuse to think in the way that all of our institutions are telling them to think. So we have Donald Trump to thank for this. He has made it necessary to draw the dividing lines so brightly, so with such blinding brightness, that the other side has come out of it has set aside any sentiment of gentlemanly discourse. They're reduced to just all this horrible screeching. Their claws are out. Their teeth are bared in a way that makes their intentions so clear. So this, again, is another reason, I believe, for optimism.
All right, excellent. Open Borders asks, did Jared ever meet William Shockley or Raymond Cattell?
Interesting question. I would love to have met William Shockley. I never did, but I did have the great honor and pleasure of meeting Raymond Cattell. I used to do a lot of consulting work in Japan. And sometimes on my way back from Japan, I would stop off for a few hours in Hawaii. There was a United Airlines flight that was a stopover of about 11 hours. It didn't add any extra charge. It was a change of planes, but you had 11 or 12 hours. And I rented a car, and I went out to where Raymond Cattell was living in Hawaii. And he was, I don't know how old he was then, but he's a wonderful man, a wonderful, wonderful man. And it was really a great pleasure and an honor to have the opportunity to meet him. I met his wife, who was a lovely woman, clearly devoted to Raymond Cattell. It was really a joy to be able to meet someone and to tell him how much I respected and admired his work. It later transpired that for his many contributions to the study of intelligence and psychometry, he was nominated for a Lifetime Achievement Award, but then some busybodies got together and dug up some of the very sensible things he said about eugenics. And near the end of his life, he was humiliated in the most spectacular way by having this offer withdrawn. And he was insulted right at the end of his life when he should have been honored by the entirety of his profession. So, yes.
That's disgusting. A similar thing happened to Roger Scruton and also the scientist who discovered DNA. I can never remember.
James Watson. James, what?
And he's still alive. But
yes. What a tragedy. It is disgusting what was done to him. Absolutely disgusting. And of course, this is such a terrible message to any young scientist. Here, perhaps the most respected living scientist in the world can be humiliated, insulted, denigrated in this vicious way. Ah, it is just an embarrassment, absolute embarrassment. It makes you, it reminds me of something Mark Twain once said. What was it exactly? He said, sometimes you feel as though you want to, what is it he said? In any case, just give up on the whole thing and to hell with the whole damned human race. Though the way he was treated
makes you want to Fed post. Yeah. I don't think he said that. Oh, exactly.
Only said, yeah, end the farce. Just, let's see, get rid of the entire human race and end the farce, I believe is how he put it. I'll have to get back to that quotation so I can put it in the remarkable terms he used and not stumble around with it. But no, it makes me ashamed to be a human being to share the species with such idiots.
Yes. All right. No Chance asks, how can we effectively reverse the civil rights era lawfare that created a double standard which only handicaps whites? It's basically illegal for whites to go their own way of a sustained majority. Yes. Well, you know, it sounds pie in the sky, but look what just happened with Roe versus Wade.
Yes.
You know, maybe the civil rights stuff could be attacked in the same way.
Well, the civil rights laws are quite explicit. You're not supposed to discriminate on the basis of race. And through an astonishing series of Supreme Court decisions, those laws have been turned on their head and made to justify racial discrimination, so long as you're discriminating against people other than blacks or Hispanics. And nowadays, you can discriminate against Asians to some degree. So we have had the Supreme Court decision on affirmative action, racial preferences. That's given us at least three quarters of a loaf. As you probably know, there is this little loophole left in college applications at any rate, which a college student can write a little essay about how his racial identity has meant so much for him in terms of overcoming this or that or the other. But just granting people preferences on the basis of race, that is out the door. Now, of course, all of these college administrators are putting their heads together and trying to find ways to work their way around this, but this is becoming more and more difficult. And again, the lawfare that has been directed against whites, this FIRE outfit and the America First Legal, and then their Pacific Legal Foundation, there are more and more legal public interest law firms that are working to try to eliminate at least the worst of this anti-white prejudice. So I think it can work both ways. Of course, the problem is the more you find non-whites in the Congress, the more difficult it becomes to pass sensible laws. And if there are Democrat administrations for the next 8 or 12 years, then there's an excellent chance the Supreme Court will be in the hands of people like Elena Kagan or Sonia Sotomayor. I think they would have absolutely no difficulty finding that the Constitution certainly allows for remedial treatment for the victims of institutional racism. They would find no difficulty recognizing that the First Amendment, which guarantees free speech, does not cover hate speech, and they will define that broadly. All of that could be vitiated by a vicious Supreme Court, which is not difficult to imagine.
Yes, unfortunately, it is really a matter of who is in charge, who is in these positions.
Yes.
Potato Mutt, does Amren have any plans for Gregory Hood to continue the Left, Right and White podcast?
Ah.
Or did that perish with the death of his co-host?
It died when his co-host died. This was really a tragedy. His real name was Martin Rojas. He went by the name of Chris Roberts. It was a very shocking thing. He wasn't even 30 years old. But we are probably about to announce the resumption of Right, Left, and White. So the answer to that question is de volente, yes. And we have very high hopes. We have a candidate in mind. And I think we will be announcing very shortly that this has resumed. I'm delighted to hear that there was a fan for that podcast.
Oh, excellent. Okay. The Mikado, thanks for your continued work. A question for Jared. Would you be willing to return to Twitter or /X in the event of an unbanning? We all live in hope. So if you were if your account was reinstated, would you return? Would you use it?
Yes. The answer is yes.
Of course. That's the only sensible answer, really.
Yes, I'm a little bit surprised. Although, I must say this. I spend a lot of time doing what I do, and so it would to have a effective and functioning Twitter account, I would certainly have to spend time at that as well. So it would be something of an addition to my workload, but it would be an addition that I would be delighted to undertake. I've tried my best to be reinstated, and I have many times gone through the appeals process, and I get these form email messages saying, oh, well, we'll think about it. And then they think very hard about it and say, well, you're going to keep you banned. I went to the trouble of actually writing a letter, a U.S. mail letter to Elon Musk, addressed to him personally at their San Francisco headquarters, and mailed it off. And it was a very respectful letter, but I got no reply. And I certainly wasn't reinstated on the strength of that letter. Now, I feel very fortunate. There are a number of people on X who quite often say, well, why can't you let Jared Taylor back on? Now, it seems that Elon Musk may not be reading those accounts, but I haven't completely given up hope. There are people who tell me, look, just come back on under assumed name. I believe Nick Fuentes has done precisely that. I don't like that kind of subterfuge. And perhaps it's part of my foolish optimism, but I still think it's not out of the question that I'll be let back on. As you may be aware, isn't Kevin MacDonald one of your guests? Has he already been on for this?
Yes. He unfortunately was recovering from food poisoning at the time, but he has been on.
Yes. Well, as you probably know, he had never been banned under the previous dispensation, but after Elon Musk took over, then he was banned. What the heck's this? Of course, the ADL has been beavering away trying to get people banned. I imagine that was part of the problem. Then I don't know. Do you know who James Edwards is? He has this radio program.
I've heard system. Of him.
Oh, you might consider him as a millennial guest. But he, too, he survived all of the foolishness of the Jack Dorsey and other ban types that were running Twitter. And he was banned after Elon Musk took over. So there are strange things going on. I love the idea that Elon Musk, he claims to be a free speech absolutist. Well, I wish he really were.
Yes. I agree. I do think, I mean, I wouldn't want to risk too much money on it, but I think that you will get your account back in time. But with the way things are going, it seems inevitable.
I mean, Alex Jones has been welcomed back to Twitter. I consider that a wonderful sign. I must say, to me, the real canary in the coal mine, and this particular canary in the coal mine flopped dead quite a few years ago, it would be the Daily Stormer and Andrew Anglin. That guy has probably been more viciously and rigorously banned than anyone's, more than I, and that's saying a lot. And of course, I think he should be allowed on every platform available. But to me, he is sort of, if you're a free speech absolutist, then you should let Andrew Anglin back on your platform.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. Okay, someone says, Jared, I love seeing you cross-platform with other hosts. Thank you for your intelligence.
Oh, well. Well, I like being cross-posted too. It's always a pleasure to speak with either a friendly interlocutor or a hostile interlocutor. I find both experiences interesting. I mean, millennial woes. You are a very good interviewer. You've been doing it for years. I think you're good at directing the conversation, asking good questions. And that is always a particular pleasure. On the other hand, again, I enjoy hostile interviews. And I suppose I enjoy them because I invariably know so much more about the subject than they do. Most liberals, they've never really even looked into the kinds of arguments that we can so easily make. And I almost feel as though I take advantage of them because they're asking questions about subjects about which they're so woefully ignorant. And
The absolute classic was The Rugged Man. I've mentioned it before. Oh. I just think it was a hilarious, you know, there are sometimes with live streaming, you end up with these little slices of internet history where it's just like a priceless combination of people who would never otherwise. It's that unique combination. Well, and you with him is just the height of absurdity. And it's so entertaining to watch.
I thought at first he was just joking with me. He took one absurd position after another. I thought he was baiting me. And it eventually dawned on me that he believed what he was saying. What a comic feast that was.
Oh, yeah. Wonderful. Yeah, everyone should seek that out. The Jared Taylor versus The Rugged Man. It was organized by Gavin McInnes.
Yes. Very fine fellow, McInnes.
Farce of a debate. You know, yeah. So anyway, but yeah, that's not the only one. You've obviously debated many people, some more competent than others. I mean, I shouldn't claim that they're all like that. Not at all.
Not at all. Yeah.
And there's a good range. I mean, debating is something that you are very well versed in, far better at it than I am.
And
I'm not good at debating. I'm too nice. apart from anything else. But yeah, it's one of the things that you've really contributed to all of this is interacting with people who oppose us and trashing them usually.
It's a disappointment that I don't get more opportunities. People have given up wanting to debate me. It's too bad. Just the other day, though, it wasn't really a debate, but I was interviewed by an American lady who has been doing 23andMe and looking into her heritage, and she discovered that I believe she had about 15 or 20% Black ancestry, of which she had been ignorant. And she's kind of trying to come to terms with this. What is her identity? And so she doesn't at all like the idea of white racial consciousness. But we had a very pleasant conversation. And it was refreshing to find that someone who disagrees the way liberals do, but who was able to couch her complaints or her objections or her questions in an entirely polite and reasonable way. It was really a very pleasant conversation despite our profound disagreements. And that's the way debate should be. And after I had gotten off the air, I overheard her saying, well, you know, I disagree with this guy, but this is really the way debate should be. And I salute her. I salute her absolutely for being able to talk about these rather sensitive questions and from the opposing point of view, but in a way that is reasoned, that is not vicious. It can be done.
Yes, it can. I think it depends on a certain level of civility to which not many people are actually accustomed nowadays, frankly.
Yes.
All right. Okay. And then Hinchfoot says, tip for the fabulous millennial streams, keep up the good work. Thank you very much. Yes. And then there's a very generous donation from Penelope. Mm. Thank you very much indeed. That's the most generous super chat so far this year. I doubt it will be bested. But if anyone wants to have a go, please do. And the question is, dear Mr. Taylor, Merry Christmas. Thank you for all that you do for white people. Kindest regards, Penelope.
Oh, well, Penelope, that is a delightful message. And kindest regards to you.
That's very nice. And then there are super chats from other people on Odyssey. On Entropy. So I'll get to those now. Okay. And somebody asked earlier, and this is from Epsilon Indy. Thank you very much. He says, Jared Taylor, how do you stay so cool when being interviewed by anti-white morons? Kind of related to what we were just saying.
I don't know. I suppose years ago, it dawned on me that anyone who loses his temper essentially loses the argument. Anyone who starts calling names or becomes incoherent, none of that adds to your message. It's just a matter of trying to be as effective as possible. I don't think it's such a difficult thing. One thing that I have to control is that if my interlocutor says particularly stupid things, I shouldn't roll my eyes or grin foolishly. I should probably be a little bit more sober when people make fools of themselves. Let the audience roll its eyes rather than behaving in an ungentlemanly way. But not getting angry, I don't find that particularly difficult at all. I think because years ago, it seemed very clear to me that anyone who loses temper or gets emotional loses control of the conversation and makes himself that much less credible.
Yeah, it's actually bad for yourself to get angry during
very bad.
It's bad tactics.
Yes.
All right. This is Black Pigeon Pilled. My brother and I were among those eager to see you in Estonia earlier this year for Frodi Midgard's Skanza Forum. I wondered if you could speak on the international persecution that you've personally confronted and whether 2024 will see you both the speaker and us, the audience, freer to interact without intrusion and intimidation.
Well, to summarize my situation very clearly, I guess it was about 6 years ago, I was invited by a Polish group called All Polish Youth to give a number of talks in Poland, which I did. And All Polish Youth is a Christian nationalist organization. There's nothing jackbooted. They don't run around Sieg Heiling. And yet, they appear to have had an informer in their midst who reported that I was a dangerous Nazi. And as a result, without telling me, the Polish authorities put on a Schengen ban. That means all of the 27 or 28 countries in the Schengen group were ordered to not allow me to set foot in any of those countries. Well, they didn't tell me. And so a couple of years later, I went back to Europe with the expert, and I'd lined up a week or 10 days of talks, lectures. In fact, I believe it was it was a Skanza Forum meeting.
It was Skanza Forum in Stockholm.
That's right, the Skanza Forum in Stockholm. And so I couldn't make that, and I couldn't make all the other appointments. I can tell you, it was furious. Well, I was told that I'd been banned for 3 years. Well, I can count to three. And although, in the meantime, I had tried to reach the Polish authorities every possible way that I could. I had documents translated into Polish, and I was completely and utterly stonewalled. I even went to the American State Department, and I said, look, the Poles have done this to me. And as my representative in dealing with the Polish government, can you ask them why? And can you please tell them to stop? And it took them very little time at all to get back to me and say, well, this is a matter of, this is a decision to be made by the Polish authorities. Now, if I'd been some lesbian black lady basketball player, I think some of your viewers will know exactly whom I'm speaking of, detained by the Russians. If I were one of their pets, they would have gone to bat for me. But since I was on the wrong side of the political fence, they didn't care. In any case, well, I thought the 3 years were up. And so earlier this year I went to Skanza, or I thought I was going to Skanza, and I was turned back again. And I learned that my ban had been extended by another 2 years. Again, they didn't have the courtesy to tell me. So I make all of these plans, I have all of these meetings lined up, and I think it's probably not difficult to imagine how frustrating it is to have made plans, people, audiences, and people are expecting to see you at conferences, meetings. And I have to tell them, well, I'm sorry, I had to go on the next plane and go home. Absolutely infuriating. Well, as it turns out, I located a person in Poland, and I granted him power of attorney, and that enabled him to contact the Ministry of Foreigners, as it's called, on my behalf. And I learned that that two-year extension, now that it has expired, my ban has not been renewed. So at least for now, apparently, I am free to travel to Europe. So I hope that I will be able to get back to the continent of my ancestors. The other aspect of my international persecution is that, oh gosh, I can't even remember how long ago it was now, maybe back in 2016, Theresa May, when she was Home Secretary, this is before she was named Prime Minister of England, she wrote me a stiff letter saying that I was unwelcome in the United Kingdom. Apparently, I poisoned the air, and that I was not to even to attempt to set foot in Her Majesty's realm. So I'm banned for them from Britain, and this is without any kind of time limit. Occasionally, I write the authorities and I say, "Have you changed your mind?" And they say, "No, we haven't." And this is particularly this is particularly galling to me because my younger daughter is living in Britain. She went to university at Royal Holloway College. And so I can't even visit her. I wrote them and I said, look, just as a humanitarian matter, might I visit my daughter? And they said, no. I thought that was distinctly unkind, but at least they warned me that I'm not welcome within the realm. I can't even change planes, even within the restricted area of the transit lounge. I apparently would just loose so many foul ideas into the air of Great Britain that I am persona non grata. So the land of the largest number of my direct ancestors has permanently barred me from ever entering. But so we'll see.
It's just absurd. Absolutely absurd.
It is here. This is the continent of my ancestors, of my culture, the continent I love more than any other. And I feel that Europe has no better friend living overseas than myself. And Europe lets in all of these horrible people who hate Europe, who hate our people, who hate everything about us. And I, who love our people and our culture and want the very best for all Europeans, I am not allowed to visit. It is a topsy-turvy world, isn't it?
And yeah, it's obscene, really. Mm. And as you say, I think you're right. I agree with you that Europeans would struggle to find a better friend than Jared Taylor. All right. Cronin says, thank you both. Mr. Taylor is an essential speaker on our side. Merry Christmas. Oh, I agree.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Very kind.
Thank you. And Hinchfoot asks, Uncle Jared, do you retain any Japanese traditions in your life now?
Well, the Japanese tradition that I most rigorously maintain is that I require that everyone crossing my threshold take his shoes off. That is one. I think something else that I retain from growing up in Japan is an absolute abhorrence for calling strangers by their first names. Japanese is a very polite language. It's a very hierarchical language. And the idea of meeting a first-time acquaintance and calling that person by his first name, that's just unthinkable. And so I maintain a certain formality that probably is part of that. I mean, that's not a kind of formality that is utterly unknown in the West. But I think in those two respects, perhaps I have maintained something of my Japanese upbringing. or my upbringing in Japan. My upbringing was by Americans, of course. It just happened to take place in Japan. Now, many people seem to think that the fact of having grown up in a homogeneous country must have affected my politics, but I honestly believe that was not the case. And I was an integrationist, a good little liberal, probably until I was in my 30s. So it didn't have that effect, but it did affect me on those two points, something of a formality of language and also the desire to keep the dirt out by keeping people's shoes at the door.
All right. And let me see. Okay, K-Max, if the outcome of World War II had been different, would we be in a different position today? Or just the two world wars happening at all was the cause? Post-World War II, Europeans seemed to favour opposing their own people and interests while favouring everyone else instead. I think this is about the demonisation of nationalism and patriotism after World War II.
Yes, I think both wars were devastating to us, not only in terms of killing off the best of our breed. There is a wonderful book by Robert Starr Jordan called War and the Breed, with little brief biographies and photographs of Europeans who died in the Great War. The First World War was one that caused a tremendous amount of soul searching among Europeans. And then 19 years later, we engage in yet another horrible, horrible self-slaughter. I wasn't alive at the time, and so I didn't personally experience this horrible, agonizing self-reappraisal that took place as a consequence of those two devastating experiences. But they were like the Peloponnesian Wars. Greece never recovered from the Peloponnesian War. And I think the West has not recovered from those two horrible wars. Now, what would have happened if Nazi Germany had won the war? Well, I think that certainly this self-loathing of Europeans would absolutely not have come to pass. I think we can say that with a considerable confidence. Let us imagine even that Germany under Hitler had not gone to war in September of 1939. That too is also a possibility. If National Socialist Germany had continued as a racially conscious nationalist entity without provoking this horrible, horrible bloodletting, that too would have given us a completely different world. It's probably fruitless to think in terms of what might have been, but I think something that we can say with great confidence is that those two successive Peloponnesian Wars of the West were a terrible blow to us psychologically, biologically, and certainly even spiritually. This prepared us for a kind of capitulation that echoes even unto today and, alas, further into the future as well.
Yes. Arch Stanton says, Merry Christmas. One of my favorite hostile interview moments was when Mr. Taylor went on NPR and the smug liberal asked him, what's so bad about being a minority? Ironic, since they're the ones always whinging about downtrodden minorities. Well, exactly. It's a blatant contradiction. But Jared.
Well, I don't remember that interview very well. I'm rarely interviewed by National Public Radio. But what I remember best about that interview was I was asked, did I listen to National Public Radio? And I said, yes, of course. It's very important to know what you fancy liberal types are thinking. And I can invariably listen to National Public Radio. And then I know that I'm on the right track if I simply believe the opposite. I enjoyed having an opportunity to say that to the NPR audience.
Very good. Pox Populi says, I read that Mr. Taylor is aware of all of our efforts to get him back on Twitter. Has he tried or will he try to appeal his ban and join us there? You've already dealt with that.
Yes, I've appealed many times. And thank you very much for the efforts of all of you out there. I thank you.
I really appreciate people almost every day saying, when is Amren going to be, I think it's Amren official, is going to be reinstated. Yeah.
Yes.
Definitely. Black Pigeon Pilled. Has Jared seen recent advertisements for the new upcoming film, The American Society of Magical Negroes? And if so, what is his assessment?
I have heard of this movie. I think it isn't it the Society of the Society of Magical Negroes. I haven't made much of an effort. I've heard of its name. I'd love to know what it's about. On the subject of movies, however, and I don't know if we have time. Maybe you've got many super chats, and I should keep my answers brief. But on the subject of movies, there is a black movie director by the name of Tyler Perry. And probably hardly known at all outside the United States, hardly known outside the circle of his fans, which are mostly black women. But Tyler Perry has made himself a billionaire as an independent filmmaker. And the very nasty chip on the shoulder black movie maker, Spike Lee, says that he dismisses Tyler Perry's movies as coonery buffoonery. And there is a certain truth to that, but I finally watched a Tyler Perry movie, and it does make fun of black people, and but it also it makes fun of white people, but it doesn't treat white people as any more stupid or buffoonish than black people. And I urge any of your viewers, this is a strange window into the thinking of Tyler Perry's fans, of which there's an enormous number. As I say, enough to make him a billionaire. It's a kind of exercise in cultural anthropology to watch a Tyler Perry movie. And I found some of its settings really quite funny. I laughed out loud several times while I was conducting my cultural anthropology. Now, the only difference that I would say, now, I don't watch much in the way of comedies, and these are comedies. They're supposed to make you laugh and entertain you. I don't watch much in the way of comedy, but I'm sure that compared to a comedy put together by white people for white people, the sexual innuendo is much broader, much more obvious. And it's intriguing to me that this is something that apparently appeals to a black audience. Now, there wasn't any kind of nudity, no bear this or bear that, but the way people talked, there was a very blatant and brazen kind of sexuality. So, but that was the only thing that I found startling. But there is a kind of almost a wholesome ability of this Tyler Perry guy to make fun of his own people. And so I mean, probably one of his movies is enough. But on the subject of movies, you can do worse than spend an evening with Tyler Perry. Now, we'll see about the Society of Magical Negroes. Of course, I was thinking when I first heard of that title of a movie that that's probably once the other side has completely taken over, and Washington, D.C. has been named Mandela because Washington was a slave owner, and we've decided the United States of America is not a good name for this white supremacist country. They can rename the country the Society of Magical Negroes.
All right. I'll just race through the super chats.
I'll race through my answers.
Okay, there are quite a few.
All right.
The N. Reeb says, today I drove past an ordinary row of terraced houses built over 150 years ago. I typed into Google African architecture and the top result was the pyramids. This is about the racial differences, cultural, obviously, and the pyramids were not built by black people. That's something that came up in your debate with the rugged man. He thought that Tutankhamun was black.
Mm. Yeah. Well, we was Kangs after all.
Yeah, exactly, that whole thing.
Yes.
All right. Not Finished says, one thing just as ridiculous as liberals thinking the answer to racial differences is extermination is conservative thinking this situation will end without conflict. Yeah, I agree. Things are not going to be peaceful. This situation that exists today, conflict is inevitable. And that's not me advocating it or wanting it. I'm just saying that is what I foresee in the future. You can't have groups coexisting. I mean, you said earlier that blacks and Hispanics don't like each other. In Britain, I think last year, around this time last year, it was Hindus and Muslims. So that's two groups of brown people who don't like each other. Diversity is leads to conflict. It's just a fact. Okay, K-Max. Jared, whenever I go to a doctor's office or see computer workers, I'm seeing 80% Asian workers there. Is this a hiring discrimination thing, or have white people just lost that hunger? I feel dysgenics has hurt our race as well. Our smartest people don't have enough kids, or we don't stress education enough. Oh dear, where's he gone? Oh no, I didn't even know he's dropped out. Let's see what's happened. Damn. Let's see if he comes back. Sorry, everyone. Let's see. It's probably an internet outage. Unless he accidentally pressed a button. Like Kevin McDonald did the other night. Hold on. Oh, here he is.
Yes,
hello, welcome back.
Well, thank you. I had a struggle with Moriarty and we went over the falls. I appeared to die.
But now you're raking back.
I clambered my way back up. I beg your pardon for that sudden disappearance.
All right, don't worry. Excellent. It's not too disruptive. It's fine. So the question was about Asian workers in computer IT sector. Oh, the person saying that white people don't seem to get good middle class jobs anymore. And he's asking, is it about dysgenics? Are smart people not having enough kids? Or do we not stress education enough?
Well, smart people certainly are not having enough kids. That is a terrible thing. White people are not having enough kids, period. And we really must do something about that. At least the Hungarians are really trying very hard, and they may succeed to get their total fertility rate up above replacement level. But this question of getting the high IQ people to have more children is really a terrible, terrible challenge for the entire world. Now, as far as IT is concerned, this is all part of this effort to enforce diversity, equity, inclusion, all of that. And when you can do that, when you can be prejudiced or discriminate against whites in a way that doesn't kill your company, in other words, if you can hire competent Asians, then that becomes a real benefit for them. But this whole question, we could have an entire conversation about dysgenic fertility. Unquestionably, smart people are not having enough children, stupid people are having far too many, and white people are not having enough children. And we really need to think seriously about how to correct that problem.
Certainly. Okay, Kataman, do you think it is necessary to end the American empire in order to fix all of this? We have the WikiLeaks that U.S. government forces this on all occupied countries with U.S. bases.
Yes. No question about it. The international effect of the United States is a terrible one. We seem to make it our business to concoct and brew up all sorts of poisons and then pump them into the bloodstream of every white country all around the world. I remember the classic example of this was just before Kabul fell, and after we had occupied Afghanistan for 20 years. There is a tweet from the U.S. Embassy reminding all of the Muslims in Afghanistan that this was Gay Pride Week, and we are supposed to be celebrating the multi-culti universe of homosexuals everywhere. And this is really fiddling while Rome burns in the worst possible way. And many people, I know the French, for example, they keep an eye on what the United States is up to. And we are constantly getting in touch with non-white groups in France and encouraging them to exercise any kind of identitarian politics possible. So no question about it. the American influence in the world is a terrible one, and the sooner it ends, the better.
Yeah, I agree. Can Jared comment on how terror attacks have all but evaporated in the last few years, since 2018, 2017, and proffer any reasons for this apparent change among the enemies of the West?
You know, that's a very good and important observation. I don't have an answer for you. In the United States, we never had as many as there were in Europe. We don't have quite as many Muslims, and we don't have quite as many fanatical Christianity and Europe-hating Muslims. I don't have a good answer. Now, I know that some people are predicting, certainly in the United States and perhaps in Europe as well, that because of this Hamas-Israel war, and also in the case of the United States, we have been letting in millions of utterly unvetted people across our southern border. And some of them, there've actually been a number who have been picked up, several hundred, that are on the terrorism watch list. Now, there are uncounted hundreds of thousands who slip in without our ever seeing them. And included among those are undoubtedly terrorists. But I share your viewers' surprise that there have not been nearly as many as there was at one time. And I am expecting certainly an increase for those two reasons, because of what's going on in the Middle East. And certainly in the United States, the number of utterly unvetted, unknown people who have been sneaking into the country.
Yes, indeed. It's an alarming thing and baffling. I don't understand it either, why this absence of terror attacks, given that it just seemed to be going up and up and up and up, yeah, and then stopped. It's weird.
I don't know.
Yeah. Okay. Tim says, you both seem to take the evolutionary hypothesis as a given, but are you open to the idea that the scientific rigor backing up evolution is at about the same level as climate change alarmism? For example, scientists can't even agree what a species is. Well, yeah, okay, Jared, it's you people.
Well, the usual definition of a species is a collection of individual organisms that can produce fertile young. In other words, you can mate a donkey and a horse, but they do not produce fertile young. Mules cannot reproduce. And so horses and donkeys, therefore, are different species. In the case of dogs, you can have dog breeds that are very, 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 very different. But as far as I know, every one of them, I mean, some cases physically they can't reproduce because their sizes are so disparate. But if you include some kind of artificial insemination, dogs can reproduce and produce fertile young. That's the definition of a species. Now, what is more difficult and what is held against us is that there is rarely complete agreement on how many races there are. But that's not at all surprising. How many colors are there? I mean, we work perfectly well with the colors of the rainbow, but there's an infinite number of colors. Doesn't mean that because we can't agree on the number of colors that there are not colors and there are racial differences. But no, I think that the scientific basis, climate change, let's not get into that subject in particular, but I believe that certainly compared to creationism, the scientific approach that is represented by Darwinism is to me a more convincing explanation as to why we have this remarkable variety of species. The origin of species, I think, is probably evolution. Now, you may have more and better reasons to agree with that point of view.
Yeah. Like on the matter of race, here's a useful meme infographic.
Yes.
These different types, subtypes of animals,
yes,
they can produce fertile offspring together, and yet we don't call them the same.
No.
But with humans, we do. This is absurd. These divisions are meaningful, even if you don't categorize them in the same way as subspecies, species. It doesn't matter. The differences are still real. It's a question of taxonomy.
Yes.
It's a question of how we describe a reality. But the reality remains the same, regardless of the terminology that we apply to it.
Well, there is an interesting definition of subspecies. And it is one in which a naive observer, not a trained observer, can distinguish between groups, between members of a species, variations in a species, at least 9 times out of 10. And this will be something that would apply to the various kind of wildebeests, for example. I believe there are 7 or 8 different subspecies of wildebeest. And apparently, if you take naive observers, they can tell them apart reasonably well after explaining what to look for. Well, in the case of human races, good grief, you can tell them apart 100 times out of 100 if you're talking about a pygmy versus an Eskimo. So certainly by that definition, a subspecies is something that certainly exists among humans.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, on the matter of evolution, look, that's a whole thing that I don't want to get into here, but it is a legitimate thing that Tim has said, but we don't have time. Okay, K-Max, does Jared get angry at the pro-Israel crowd's double standard on immigration? Every neocon and ADL member opposed Trump's wall and ran the kids in cages meme. But then the same people support Netanyahu's machine guns at the border and his border wall. Yeah, that is a strange contradiction, is it not?
Oh, yes. This double standard has been alive and well for decades, absolute decades. I remember Yitzhak Shamir, he was prime minister of Israel, and he was assassinated by a leftist Israeli who thought he was too soft on Arabs. And I remember at one point he was describing his many accomplishments, or what he considered to be his many accomplishments. And he said that one of the things he was proudest of was he had worked very hard to make sure that Israel remained at least 80% Jewish. And God bless him for that. He recognizes that if Israel ceases to be Jewish, it will cease to be Israel in a meaningful sense. And I just tried to imagine, you know, some American president looking back over his accomplishments and saying, I'm patting myself on the back for this, that, and the other. And one of the greatest things I did was work really hard to make sure that the United States remains 80% white. Well, no, that would be Nazi. That would be white supremacist. That'd be a kluxer. And yet, a Jewish prime minister, an Israeli prime minister, can come to the United States Congress and address a joint session and talk about maintaining Israel as a Jewish state and get standing ovations. Now, this seems to be the most blatant of double standards. And I think slowly the absurdity of supporting the one and opposing the other is coming to the fore.
Yes, I agree, especially with in light of the recent Gaza conflict. I think that's exposing a lot of inconsistencies, contradictions. Yes. So, okay. Tim says, "Happy Christmas to you both." Thank you very much.
Thank you.
K-Max, is it true that AMREN conferences used to be on C-SPAN? Jared worked for National Review. How different was the system back in the 90s when AMREN started? Even Sam Francis wrote for the Washington Times.
Correct. All that could be a subject for, 20 minutes worth of jabber. But I will try to be as concise as possible. Yes, the first couple of American Renaissance conferences, several of our talks were broadcast on C-SPAN. And we always put the telephone number on the podium. This is before the days of the internet, and you wouldn't have put a URL, you'd put a telephone number. And answering the phone was such a joy because so many people called up. And the essence of their observation as soon as we picked up the phone was, "Thank God, now I know I'm not insane." Because it was very easy in those days, in the pre-internet days, to have a realistic understanding of the suicidal course that the United States had embarked upon, realities of race, and feel as though you were the only person who saw this or understood it. And so it was delightful to reassure these people, no, you're not insane. It's everybody else around you who's insane. And so, yes, I used to have my articles accepted for a National Review. And in a way, this was an odd thing. The internet opened up a huge new audience, but at the same time, it made it possible, whenever I was invited on a radio program, a talk show, for our opponents or for the radio talk show hosts or their producers to then look me up and discover that the Southern Poverty Law Center said that I was a hate monger, that I was really a frustrated goose stepper and armband waver. And so then they would disinvite me. So there was an odd kind of transition where the internet, when it was available in a really easy, when it really did believe in free speech, was a great step forward. And yet it made it easy to find out what other people were saying, the insulting things saying about me. But no, the mood has changed completely. The 1990s was very open for race realist books. I could give you a whole list of what was possible to publish by mainstream publishing houses. So there've been these strange cycles, ups and downs, of what can be said and what can't be said. That's a whole subject of at least a half an hour of jabber, which I will not inflict upon you.
All right. Okay, and Not Finished says, Merry Christmas, gentlemen. Thank you for the discussion and all the best in 2024. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ricky says, one more fan of Left, Right and White here. A brilliant podcast, and Chris Roberts was taken far too soon.
Yes. Yeah. It was terrible.
All right.
It took me weeks to reconcile myself to the fact that he was gone. We have these staff meetings, staff telephone calls sometimes every day. And suddenly, I mean, he was on regularly, always full of bursting with ideas, half of them bad, half of them good. And then suddenly to realize, he's gone. Roberts is gone. It took months for that to sink in. It was just such a horrible shock.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah.
I do remember when it happened, and people weren't quite sure, that there was sort of uncertainty about it at first because he was so young.
Yeah.
I think he was, what was he, 30?
Not yet 30. He was 29.
All right, right. That's terrible.
Yeah.
Okay, Stephen says, excellent work this year, Woz, as always. Thank you very much, Stephen. And Not Finished jokes that you were hacked by IBM earlier when it went offline. Okay, and then he also says, it's now December the 18th. On this day in 1865, slavery was abolished in the USA by white people. Mm. Well, that's an interesting point to end on, Jared.
Yes. Mm. Well, I imagine we are, if we continue, will be encroaching on your next guest's time, which we must not do.
Yes, indeed. All right, well, this has been a great stream, so thank you very much, Jared. People always look forward to your appearance every year, and it's always a pleasure to host you.
Oh, it's a pleasure and an honor to be on your program, and I didn't realize I was... the only one besides Greg Johnson. He certainly is a worthy interlocutor, and it will be my hope to appear next year if I'm invited.
Oh, yes, of course.
Well, thank you so much, and Merry Christmas, damn it.
Thank you very much. I'll be back soon with the next guest. In the meantime, Jared Taylor, as always, thank you for appearing on Millennial.
My pleasure.
Okay.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. The journey must continue, but it needs your help. T-shirts and mugs and other wondrous gifts are available at the merchandise store. Impress your family, friends, colleagues, and business partners with these incredible items.
All aboard!
Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile vlogger. Please help him continue. Until next time, enjoy the journey and spread the word.